G'day, you're on the pod with Mick and Ken from the G'day World Podcast.
It's gone.
No, don't go, Doc.
Hey there.
Doc, this is Cam and Mick. How are you?
I'm fine, how are you?
How you doing, Doc?
Let me put them in my headphones. Okay? Yeah. Let me find them. I just had them here, that way it'll prevent the slapback echo. Hold on.
Stop hitting me. What's that?
No, Cameron was busy playing his guitar, and then he looks at his email and goes, oh, they got an email from Doc Searles.
Well, hang on a sec. Gee, what did I do with my headset? Hold on. Let me look around.
Hello?
I'm here.
Hello. No, he's on the phone.
Yeah. I'm just looking around my office.
Oh, okay. Good, Angela.
I get a large, ugly headset that sounds really good. But unfortunately, I don't have a great microphone.
The number that I've got for you hasn't been working yet. Can I get
Cameron's taking it again? That's right. Cameron's taking the business call.
Okay. There we go.
An hour.
Oh, that sounds actually nice and clean now. This is a completely new version for us. We're actually, for the first time in history, we're in the same room recording a podcast.
Wow.
We're normally at other ends of, well, we're normally about 1,000 kilometres difference between us.
All right.
Well, I'm gonna increase that in this case, I think.
Look, Doc, sorry about this morning, mate. We hadn't heard from you, so we thought, oh, well, we're not going to do Doc today, and we just started dicking around and having coffee. Have you got time?
Did you see, I sent an email. I sent it kind of late. I thought it had gone out earlier. But I just sent an email. I guess it... 1 minute before 2:30 my time.
Yeah, no, we only got that about 2 minutes ago. I just didn't. Okay. I didn't have my email open. So have you? Have you still got half an hour or so to have a chat?
No, sure. No, let's make it right now if you'd like.
Excellent.
How am I sounding? Because I don't have an external microphone, so I'm talking to the computer.
Coming through
strange.
Coming through fine on this end, mate.
Yeah, no, okay. Coming through fine. Right. Coming through okay.
Excellent. Well, okay, good. Doc Searles, welcome to the G'day World podcast. Thank you so much for joining us.
Well, good day yourselves.
Now, mate, we're totally in awe of this conversation. I'm not exactly sure where to start, so you know, go easy with us.
Oh, my reputation exceeds me. I think I don't know why anybody should be in awe of anybody at this point. Well, that's one of the things I actually like about Australia. I was saying before, any place where it's politically correct to sit in the front seat with the cab driver is a good place for me.
I mean, that's how we find out what the hell's going on.
Yeah, cab drivers tell us all the news.
Yeah, you have to sit and chat to the cabbies, mate. They're hooked into everything down here.
Yeah.
As you were talking before, Mick's taking photos of your picture on Skype, but he was holding up the Clue Train manifesto. I guess Mick and I are two guys who read that when it came out, and for both of us it changed the way that we thought about what we wanted to do with our careers and the sort of impact that we thought we could have as being part of this technology thing that's been happening for the last 10 years. Do you want to give us maybe a little bit of background about the website and the book and your involvement, how you came to be involved in the Clue Train?
Sure. The Clue Train is a rant, essentially. It began as a rant, and the rant was really originated with separate conversations that Chris Locke, also known as Rage Boy, he's a good look up rageboy.com.
Yeah, and no, we read Rage Boy.
Yeah, well, Chris was having one conversation going with David Weinberger, who I knew of but did not know personally. He did commentaries at NPR, which is our public radio network here, and I always liked his commentaries. I didn't know him personally, and I knew Chris, and Chris and I had another conversation going, and in which all of us were more or less complaining to each other about the nearly absolute difference between what we were reading in the papers and seeing on the .com websites and on the publishers' websites. This is like in 1998 or so. This is the .com era was in full swing, and what we knew about the web. I mean, what was obvious to us about the web and what was being said about the web were entirely different things. For example, almost almost all of the at one point as much as $25 billion was being spent per year in Silicon Valley alone, investing in companies that not only were unproven or unprovable, but were based on the notion that the you can make money in advertising by replicating the models that we had on television and in newspapers, where you sort of capture the market, you capture a group of people. There was a big expression at that time. You captured eyeballs, right? And you targeted seats. That was what, if somebody was sitting still, you assumed they had a seat of some sort. You're going to like shoot them in the ass with advertising, I guess was the idea. And we thought this was ludicrous, and not only a waste of money, but just a complete misunderstanding of what the web is about. Rather than just empowering the supply side, which is what all of the venture capitalists were betting on, we thought the web gave an enormous amount of power, probably far more power, to the demand side of the marketplace. Anyway, we were complaining to each other about this on the phone and in email, and I don't know whether this was one of the precipitating things, but all three of us were marketing consultants. That's more or less how we made our money. And Chris and I were sharing how we approached potential clients, and I had this little thing that I used in order to filter out what amounted to clueless clients. I said, okay, well, here's my philosophy of marketing. It's my logic of marketing, which is markets are conversations, and conversation is fire. You know, the best kind of advertising is like word of mouth. It spreads like wildfire, right? And so, therefore, marketing is arson. the best marketing is setting fire to stuff and coming up with ideas that kind of catch on. And so Chris said, well, why don't we test that out? Why don't we take these things I've been saying and put them up on the web and see if they catch fire? And he got David and I together along with himself, and we added Rick Levine, who's a first-rate hacker who hacked up the website. And we just basically say, you know, started listing the things that were true that nobody was talking about until we got to 95, because that worked for Martin Luther. You know, we sort of like nailed up our 95 theses on the wall. I remember my wife at the time, the same wife I have now, I should say, at the time she said, you guys are such assholes. Oh my God. You have terrible manners with this thing. What are you doing? But it's the web. Who cares? You know, you just put this stuff up and see if it works, right? So, and at one point, Chris put together this little graphic. It was just a little GIF that said, and it's on the Clutrain site, that said, we are not seats or eyeballs or end users or consumers. We are human beings that our reach exceeds your grasp. Deal with it. And that was a big catalyst, too. I remember that energized me and probably the other guys a great deal. When Chris emailed that to us, it was like, holy shit, that says it. Let's just finish fleshing this thing out. And we put it up on the web, and within several days, the Wall Street Journal covered it. There was a front page column in the Wall Street Journal by Tom Petzinger on the marketplace section of the Wall Street Journal, which is read by approximately 100% of the business community in the U.S. I think my emails went from like 30 a day to 300 a day at that point. And then we got a book offer, not an offer, we got a bunch of agents contacted us. We took the first one who came along, a guy named David Miller, who was in Massachusetts near where David Weinberger was. And so David got together with him, and he passed the smell test, and we just went with him. And he, you know, he got us the book deal, and we wrote the book I think we put up the website in March or April. We had the book done by the end of the summer. We basically just unpacked what we said in the 95 theses. And then put it together in, you know, a book-length form. And it came out, I think, in January of 2000, just in time for the bubble to burst. And a number of people since then said, well, you did it. You made that thing go down. I don't know. It certainly would have collapsed under its own weight in any case. But I'm glad to take some of the credit.
I mean, markets are conversations. That's probably one of the most well-quoted out of the 95 theses. And especially... Especially now, when you're looking at blogs and stuff like that, everyone sort of brings up markets of conversations. But what's the favorite of yours out of the 95?
Well, that is the one of the 95 that I can claim having authored alone. The funny thing there is that I've been saying markets of conversations for years at that point, and it just never caught on. it took getting together with those other three guys and putting it at the front of the train, as it were, to make that work. I mean, the others that stand out for me are like Hyperlink, Subvert, Hierarchy.
Mm-hmm.
There's a line that was up earlier. It wasn't among the 95, but it basically reduced to networked markets get smarter, faster than most companies. And that line was very useful in the recent political campaign season that we had here in the U.S., where the Howard Dean campaign was very energized around the notion that that the citizenry, that the electorate, could get smarter, faster than most politicians, so that they could start a movement online that was essentially connected. It could raise money quickly. It could lead the candidate. So what happened with Howard Dean is he kind of got behind a parade, or got pushed in front of a parade that was really substantial in many ways. It did not end up working out politically, or at least in terms of electing the guy, but it changed politics almost utterly. I think in some ways what happened was that the Bush campaign took a lot of what we learned out of Clue Train and out of the experiences on both sides of that particular context and used it more effectively, especially in direct mail, for that matter. I think Markets and Conversations worked for the Republicans in the fundamentalist Christian churches. Those guys communicated very well with each other, conversed a great deal, and were much better at accepting leadership from the top than the Democrats were. But I think that all of those things were useful one way or another. To me, the main thing that happened with Clue Train, and it didn't occur to me when we were doing it. It came afterwards when a guy named Jacob Nielsen, who has or Jacob Nielsen, depending on how you want to pronounce his first name.
The man who hates Flash. Yes.
The man who hates Flash. Well, I hate Flash too, but I know some Flash that I like. But Jacob and I were on this TV show together as on a panel, and afterwards we went out for coffee, and he said, "Well, you know what happened with Clue Train? You guys were all you were all marketers who defected from marketing and went over and sided with markets." And I hadn't even thought about that before. And then I went and I looked at Clue Train again and realized that when we spoke in the first person, we were standing there with the market, yelling back at marketing. And I hadn't really thought about that before, but that's what we did. And I think that's essentially what markets are, markets in the sense of groups of people who feel like they're part of the constituency have been doing ever since. Where Clue Train, I think, was a bit of an epiphany for a lot of people was that they were so used to thinking of markets in terms of marketing, you know, that you have these targets that you're going to, not even address is the right word, you know, the language of marketing was assaultive, you know, you attacked a marketplace, you had a campaign, right, if you worked in television, you put up roadblocks. That's one of the ways you deploy advertising, and you captured the market and so forth. And it was all remarkably clueless in the context of a connected world where the customer has a lot more power than they did when they were just consumers. The line that we're not just consumers really, I think the credit there goes to Jerry Mikulski, who is associate.com, SOCIATE.com. Jerry is like the great enemy of the term consumer. He is to consumer what Jacob Nielsen is to Flash, right? He thinks that a consumer is what he calls a gullet who lives only to gulp products and crap cash, right? If you're a traditional marketer and you speak about the consumer, you're talking about, and you know, the economic equivalent of plankton. Right, you know, they're this, you know, they're krill in the ocean that the, you know, that the whales of industry can kind of sift through their baleen and munch down. That's more or less the way they viewed consumers. And and I don't think we are just consumers, and none of us did when we were doing Kutcher. I mean, really like what Jerry had to say about that. And I think at some level, most people don't like to be considered just anything, including consumers. And with the net, they had a chance to do something more than that. Now, blogging came along right about the time we were doing Clue Train, and I have to give Dave Weiner credit here for having lobbied me to start blogging, and the rest of us, I think, as well. But he got me to start blogging in the fall of 99 after we'd written the Clue Train book. And it was a regret of mine that we didn't get blogging into the book, because I saw almost instantly that blogging was going to be a perfect example of what we were talking about with Clue Train.
So it's, you know, 6 years, almost 7 years, I guess, since the website hit. What have you seen change in that time? Have you seen companies in the United States start to understand that they should alter their approach to having conversations with their customers?
Well, it's funny. I mean, I think that there are some companies that already kind of had it, even if it didn't show up on the web. Almost immediately after Clue Train came out, we started hearing from people saying, you know, we're already doing this kind of stuff. Somebody from Southwest Airlines sent me something, for example, saying, if you're looking for a clueful company, look at Southwest. We're really good at doing that anyway. Now, if you go to the Southwest website, you're not going to see anything too conversational about it. But at a human level, that's a very conversational company, and you can feel it when you ride the airplanes and when you go by the airport. I flew in and out of Burbank, California, which is where Hollywood really is, right after Southwest had its only accident in the history of the airline. A plane ran off the end of the runway and ended up parked on a thoroughfare right next to a gas station. But fortunately, nothing bad happened there. And in the airport, the people working for the airline were actually kind of joking around about it. I mean, I was amazed that there wasn't this kind of communication lockdown that happened around it. There really wasn't. It was much more of a, well, shit, bad things happen and we're moving on and, you know, it's cool. And oddly, and this is going to sound really strange, but Kmart, which is widely reviled around the world, I think has some conversational aspects to it, and which I could go into in more detail, but I'm not saying it's a completely good or healthy company by a long shot, but the practice of having old people in the community greet people at the door has been a really good one for them. Now, that's not something that shows up on the web either, but that's another example of a company that's done that. I heard from people at Coca-Cola, from The Guardian in the UK. The Guardian does not lock up their archives. They've been a very conversational medium, as it were. I think that it's been, you know, a very gradual process, though, on the whole. I think that it's for at the hacker level. See, at the level at which companies get stuff done technologically, I'm not so sure Clue Train has had that much effect. I'm sure it's had some, but I think it highlighted a kind of the Brownian conversational emotion that's necessary for companies to solve their own problems with technology. I've seen that happening for years with open source. Whenever you see a company say, you know, we've decided to standardize on Linux, like IBM, for example, show me a company that's doing that, and I'll show you a company that's been more or less taken over by its own engineers. You know, the engineers figured out what was actually going on, implemented a bunch of technology that the parent company then had to cope with in a strategic way. That's not to say that there was not a strategic decision made at the top of the company to go with Linux, but rather that they never could have made that decision if the rank and file hadn't already brought them to it at some level.
I mean, it's interesting to see sort of, you know, there are a few, you mentioned a few companies there that are looking, you know, and are sort of changing the way that they're reacting to things. I mean, I just finished working for one of Australia's largest advertising companies, a partnership with Ogilvy Mather. heading up their interactive division, and it was one of the things that really started to bug me after 4.5 years of working